Public radio is here for you. It doesn't matter how old you are, how big your home is, or what kind of car you drive. WOSU and NPR connect you to news and information in civil conversations. That's why 43 million Americans listen to NPR each week. WOSU is part of our community, covering and discussing issues important to you, standing with the facts. Meet the moment with WOSU. Go to WOSU.org/protect.
Welcome to All Sides and the Reporter Roundtable, an hour where we catch up on the political news of last week and preview the week ahead. I'm your host, Amy Jarovich. Joining me on the roundtable this week is Haley B. Miller, state government and politics reporter for the Columbus Dispatch. Welcome back, Haley.
Good to be here.
Megan Henry, reporter for the Ohio Capital Journal. Welcome back, Megan.
Thanks for having me.
And Laura Hancock, state policy and politics reporter for Cleveland.com. Welcome back, Laura.
Happy Monday.
So Attorney General Dave Yost, who vowed to stay in the governor's race until Election Day, is now out. He dropped out Friday afternoon, leaving Trump-endorsed candidate Vivek Ramaswamy as the leading Republican candidate. So, Haley, do you think that there were hints that this was coming, or were you surprised that Yost decided Friday afternoon to make that announcement?
I think this has been coming for a little while now. Yost's poll numbers were not amazing after Vivek got into the race. And we saw reporting from Notice, a Washington, D.C. news outlet, that Yost had started lobbying the Trump administration for a potential gig. When they offered him ambassador of Cyprus, he said no. But, you know, that says to me that he was looking for a way out and perhaps a more graceful or, you know, a better way out than just dropping out with nothing else in the pipeline.
Yeah. So basically he went to the Trump administration and said, hey, if I drop out and let your picked candidate have a free rein on the primary, will you give me something in return? Is that what that was?
Essentially, yeah. Yes, from my understanding.
Okay. So, and then they countered with ambassador to Cyprus, which I'm assuming was not what he was looking for. I mean, we don't know what he was looking for.
Doesn't seem like it. I mean, he said no. He probably wanted something a little bit more high profile. Ambassador to Cyprus feels a little to me like you're putting someone out to pasture a little bit. Not that I'm like an expert in U.S. diplomacy.
Arguably a pretty pasture, though. You know, Cyprus has beautiful beaches. And I Googled it after it said he turned down ambassador to Cyprus. And I was like, oh, that wouldn't be a shabby place to live, you know? Okay, so whenever he made his statement, Yost name-checked former Democratic Senator Sherrod Brown in his statement, saying Sherrod Brown and the risky progressive ideas. But Sherrod Brown isn't a declared candidate. So why do you think that he decided to name-check Sherrod Brown? Anyone?
I think there is kind of an open question about whether Brown is going to come back in 2026 to either run for governor or Senate. Brown has said he hasn't ruled out either possibility at this point, but at least for the time being, he's focused on this new nonprofit that he started, Dignity of Work Institute. But, you know, it is kind of the open question, and you see other Democrats, aside from Amy Acton, who's already in the governor's race. For the most part, I think Democrats are kind of waiting to see what Brown does, and Republicans, too, are probably wondering, you know, if he's going to be their opponent in either race.
Now, Megan, with Yost dropping out, is there much daylight between policies and like plans between Yost and Ramaswamy? Would they have been, if they would have made it all the next 11 months to the primary, would there have been a lot of difference?
I think so. Yes, I think Yost has just looking at their backgrounds alone shows like some differences in just their trajectory of how they've gotten to where they are. Yost has been a career politician. Ramaswamy has kind of jumped on the scene with being when he ran for president, the Republican nomination. So some similarities, obviously, since they are both Republicans, but definitely some differences in their policy and their backgrounds alone.
And Laura, there's been mention many a times of Lieutenant Governor Jim Tressel. He indicated that he was considering a run for governor, but he hasn't actually made an announcement. Do you think that Yost's departure could make a Tressel run more likely?
Maybe, but I think he would have jumped in already. I think there really isn't a super clear path for like a surprise Republican like that. So a spoiler kind of thing. So I don't know. Maybe he's, you know, waiting for something clearer. We have, I don't know. I saw on Twitter or last week, I saw, you know, Amy Acton claiming that there was polling showing she was really close to Ramaswamy. However, you know, I think that it was noteworthy that when Yost dropped out, he didn't mention Acton. He mentioned Sherrod Brown, who's not even officially in.
Yeah, and then there still in the race is Republican Heather Hill of Morgan County. She's a school board member there. She has little name recognition. She's considered a long shot. Haley, what do you make of her still being in the race?
I think you always see this in Republican primaries. There's always one candidate who is perceived as a long shot, but for some reason or another, they see themselves as, you know, a viable alternative to the front runner, wanting to give Republican voters a choice in the primary. I admittedly don't know much about her in terms of policy, so I don't know where she and Ramaswamy line up or disagree on the big issues, but we've seen this with Senate races. We've seen this. I mean, Joe Blystone ran against Mike DeWine for governor last time around. So I think it's pretty common.
Unless I'm remembering incorrectly, whenever the Ohio Republican Party was picking who they were going to endorse, Dave Yost wasn't there because he was at a funeral. Ramaswamy was there. But then I don't think Heather Hill was there, right? Was she? We're not sure. I don't remember. I think that she wasn't there. And I said at the time that I thought it would be a great place for like a little free publicity. But I don't. We're not sure. I don't remember.
I was not there, but I do not recall her being there.
In the reporting, I don't recall that. Yeah. Well, so on the Democratic side so far, Dr. Amy Acton, the former state health director, is still the sole Democratic candidate for governor in 2026. Former Democratic Congressman Tim Ryan said in an interview for the state of Ohio that he'll decide this summer whether to enter the race or not. Megan, do you agree with what Haley said earlier? Do you think he's waiting to see what Sherrod Brown does, or do you think he will just enter the race?
I think it's very possible he could wait to see what Sherrod Brown does. I'm curious, with Dave Yost dropping out at this point, if this will make Tim Ryan jump into the race maybe quicker, perhaps, instead of waiting around for Sherrod Brown. But I guess we'll wait and see what happens. I mean, summer is kind of ambiguous. We're already almost over with May. May's almost over. So we could see him jumping in sooner rather than later, potentially.
And the new chairperson for the Ohio Democratic Party has a lot of work to do because they also have not put up candidates yet for any of the lower level, you know, attorney general or auditor, that kind of thing.
Yeah, we really are just in this strange limbo on the Democratic side, aside from Amy Acton. I mean, she's been the only one to just kind of get ahead of all of this and jump in. But, you know, you see the rest of the party, again, waiting to see what Sherrod Brown does, maybe waiting to see what Tim Ryan does. And, you know, the clock is ticking. Election seasons are unfortunately getting longer and longer. So while we do have a year to go until the May 2026 primary, you need time to raise money to build your name ID. And, you know, I think there's also a question, too, of what bench the Ohio Democrats have at this point.
This is the Reporter Roundtable from All Sides. I'm Amy Jarovich. With me in the studio is Megan Henry, reporter for the Ohio Capital Journal, Laura Hancock, state policy and politics reporter for Cleveland.com, and Haley B. Miller, state government and politics reporter for Columbus Dispatch. Moving on, away from the governor's race, to property taxes. What to do about Ohio property taxes? More than a dozen bills are circulating the State House, but so far, no meaningful reform has made it through the legislature. And now comes a new idea. Just eliminate property taxes altogether and leave it up to the voters. That's the thinking behind a proposed constitutional amendment, and it's cleared two hurdles recently. Attorney General Dave Yost approved the title and language. It moved on to the Ohio ballot board, which gave some approval last week. Haley, this seems to be pretty fast to start for a ballot issue. Can you walk us through what the ballot board said last week?
So the ballot board meeting last week was just a procedural one. They had to decide if the amendment should be split up or if it's just one constitutional amendment. They did that. But then, you know, Secretary of State Frank LaRose at the end of the meeting made the pitch that he's been making for some time now, which is that he doesn't think constitutional amendments are the way to govern. And it was interesting. There was a village mayor who was there on behalf of this organization. And he was asked about LaRose's comments. And he was like, yeah, we agree. Honestly, we wanted the legislature to do something on property taxes, and we haven't. And in other conversations I've had with this group, you know, they have described this as kind of a last ditch effort to do something to help themselves.
Mm. Now, the Citizens for Property Tax Reform is the group behind this amendment proposal. Megan, do you, they have a long way to go. I mean, to get this on the ballot, they have a lot to do. Do you know more about this group?
A little bit. So they're up, I believe, in the Cuyahoga County area, Northeast Ohio. And yes, they have to get, I forget the exact number, but so many signatures by the end of June, I believe, in order to send it off to...
My producer, Aaron Rabinowitz, put the number in here. They need to gather 413,487 signatures, if you can catch up with that number on the radio.
Yes, thank you. So in theory, they'll collect. They'll want to collect more, mm-hmm. so that way they can have enough to meet the threshold to be verified by Ohio Secretary of State Frank LaRose in order to get on the ballot. But I believe my understanding is that they are just, yeah, fed up with these high property mm-hmm. taxes and are frustrated that nothing is being done. And so although it is a bit extreme, a big question that I've seen, which is covering education, is how this would affect public school funding.
Yeah, Laura, the schools are uneasy about this proposal, obviously. This is a significant way schools are funded. Mm-hmm. Columbus City School Superintendent Angela Chapman said in a press conference last week that the loss of property tax funding would be significant.
Yes. Right?
Is that significant? Seems like too small of a word.
This could be devastating to public schools because they... sort of depending on the school district. I mean, some school districts, almost 90% of their funding is coming from their local taxes. So this could really hurt them. Also libraries, boards of developmental disabilities, alcohol drug rehab boards, things like that. Lots of parts of local government depend on property taxes. The thing about this is, if you think for 15 seconds, hey, would you like to sign this petition to not have property taxes anymore? Sounds like a great idea.
Sure.
Yeah. But if people think it through, maybe they would say no. So it's going to be interesting to see, you know, if they're going to get the signatures. They do not have paid signature gatherers. They're not well funded. And so so it'll be interesting because in order for a signature to be considered valid and to count, you have to be like a registered voter and you have to live where your voter registration says. So a lot of times signatures do get kind of knocked off when they're doing the count. Because it doesn't match up. So
you mean like people move?
Yeah, people move sign it, and they don't think to update their voter registration. Okay. And then that won't count, you know. And so, you know, so it's going to be interesting to see. Generally, you try to get twice as many. So around 800,000, 900,000 signatures. And they just have, you know, they don't have paid signature gatherers. It's all volunteers. And so they do have sort of a long hurdle. But, you know, the idea on a very like surface level is very appealing. Leaders in both parties in the legislature say this isn't a good idea.
The Columbus Metropolitan Club devoted an hour to property taxes last week. And Greg Lawson is a research fellow for the conservative Buckeye Institute. And he's not a fan. This is a part of his comments.
I do think it's a bad idea. I think it's actually a terrible idea. It will blow holes in budgets, and it will either do one of two things. Either you will have to cut services. And in this case, we're not talking about cutting services with scalpels. We're talking about using meat cleavers to cut things. So it's really, really significant what would happen. Or you're going to have to raise income taxes. We could do income taxes at the school district level, but you'd be jacking the income tax rate up at the local level to really high rates. Or you'd be having to do some sort of a hybrid with sales tax, which creates all kinds of other problems.
So, Haley, you might indicate that you are going down the wrong path if even a conservative think tank would arguably want taxes lower, but they even think this is a bad idea.
Yeah, and, you know, I think he articulated the reason why a conservative group would feel that way, because if there aren't property taxes, you have to make up for it somewhere. This is a group that's been pushing for income tax cuts forever, and, you know... you would have to raise the income tax or you would have to raise the sales tax, which affects everyone. And so there's just a lot that here that I think, you know, both sides of the aisle, both ideologies, you know, there's just, it's not popular among a lot of like the think tanks and the lawmakers. But to Laura's point, if you just ask someone, do you want to get rid of your property taxes? You know, I think the answer is probably sure. Why not? I mean, I've gotten like a ton of emails from readers being like, where do I sign? You know, yeah. It's
well, Megan, do you think that this is one kind of a situation where they're kind of like saying to the lawmakers, just do something, fix this. Property taxes are out of control. And if you're not going to do something, we're going to go to this extreme measure.
Potentially, yes. I think that comes up, you know, with these kinds of constitutional amendments. So I think it can be kind of a message to lawmakers. So, you know, just do something, or if you're not going to do something, us, the citizens, we will do something instead. So I think it could be. I'm curious to see how the signatures will shake out and if it will actually get on the ballot or not.
Now, they to get it on the November ballot, they have to do this all, did you say, by July? Or I don't know the dates.
Yeah, it's like early July, but they also could.
Can they punt a whole year?
They can punt, yeah.
Okay. So like what the attorney general agreed to in the ballot board, that carries over for a little while. They have time.
Yeah, if they don't make this November, they could try for next November, which would obviously give them way more time to get signatures. But, you know, I think this advocates would like to get on the ballot sooner rather than later if they can.
Okay. Well, coming up, we're going to find out why Florida Governor Ron DeSantis decided to visit Ohio last week. That is when All Sides and the Reporter Roundtable continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Planet Money helps you understand the economy. We find the people at the center of the story.
Garbage in New York, that was like a controlled substance.
We show you how money influences everything.
Tell me what you like by telling me how you spend your money.
And we dig until we get answers.
I had a bad feeling you're going to bring that up.
Planet Money finds out. All you have to do is listen. The Planet Money Podcast from NPR.
You're listening to the All Sides Weekly Reporter Roundtable, an hour where we talk all things Ohio politics. I'm your host, Amy Jarovich. Still with us, Haley B. Miller, state government and politics reporter for the Columbus Dispatch, Megan Henry, reporter for the Ohio Capital Journal, and Laura Hancock, state policy and politics reporter for Cleveland.com. Florida Governor Ron DeSantis came to Ohio last week to gather support for a national convention of states. The goal is to enact term limits for members of Congress, an issue that he says enjoys bipartisan support.
Republican, Democrat, rich, poor, male, female, black, white, it doesn't matter. People support term limits. You ought to do the right thing for the right reason. But this happens to also be very good politics for the members of the Ohio legislature to sign up for, because people are going to want to see this as something that is that is getting legs, and it will get legs. And if Ohio comes, that's going to lead to many more states, I think, pretty shortly doing it.
All right. So, Haley, he wants to get Ohio on board to call for this national convention of states. What have lawmakers said about it?
Republicans are sponsoring a couple different resolutions that would call for a convention of states, one specifically for term limits, another one for term limits and some other stuff. You know, I think lawmakers that are sponsoring those resolutions agree that term limits in Congress are important. They think that the federal government has basically gotten out of control, has kind of run away with power, and they feel like this convention of states could do something about that. But I think there's some skepticism among Democrats, liberal groups about, you know, if one of these conventions was called, which, as a side note, has never happened, that, you know, there could be a runaway convention that, you know, bad actors could use it to make like wholesale changes to the Constitution.
Now, 34 states are needed to call for a convention. And does Ron DeSantis say he has about a dozen signed on? Is that right?
That sounds about right. I think like a dozen, or for some reason I have the number 19 in my head. states that have called for term limits in some fashion or another. Florida is one of them. And so Ohio would join that mix. But, you know, there's still a little ways to go, even if Ohio gets on board.
Now, Laura, Haley said that this has never happened before, but it's been tried before, right?
Oh, yeah. And there's another one called the Article 5 Convention of States, and that's trying to redo everything in the Constitution. Mm-hmm. And that one could really go runaway, too. I would say about 10 years ago, I was a reporter in Wyoming, and John Kasich came to the Wyoming legislature and held a press conference. At the time, he was governor of Ohio, but he was like sort of always running for president. And he came to promote the Convention of States. Now, unlike Ron DeSantis, who had Ohio House Speaker Matt Huffman like at the press conference with him, John Kasich didn't have any legislative leadership in Wyoming.
Wyoming was not on board.
Yeah, because they were like, well, California, you know, all the liberal big states, New York, you know, they're going to have more delegates to this convention, and anything Wyoming would want would be like ignored because they Wyoming doesn't have the population. So leaders of the legislature were not on board with this, but this is always a way for people to get exposure.
Yeah. So you mentioned the movement known as an Article 5 convention is being pushed by conservatives, and it raised concerns for good government groups like Common Cause. Common Cause calls such a move dangerous and points out that there are no rules at such conventions and how they could operate. There's just this mechanism for how to call one. And DeSantis, in his remarks here in Ohio, he did acknowledge those concerns. This is what he said.
People say, well, you've never done a convention of the states. Could you have a runaway convention and just have them write an entirely new constitution? The answer to that is basically no.
So DeSantis, I mean, he was here in Ohio. He was trying to do this. Haley, did he have another motive? Why here? Why Ohio?
He says he had no other motive. You know, he was asked if this had anything to do with potential future political ambitions. He obviously tried running for president once before, and I think it's an open question about whether he'll try again. But he said that this is something he's been advocating for a while now, and he does have Ohio ties that he likes to bring up when he's in Ohio. His parents and his wife have roots here. So, you know, he said that this is just about term limits and that's it. You know, he talked about his own experience in Congress and how that kind of spurred his interest in this topic.
There's arguments against this, which is when you lose institutional knowledge, when you lose somebody with 20, 30 years who really knows the budget like the back of their hand, then you basically have lobbyists. You become very dependent on lobbyists to kind of explain like how things work and how a certain program is funded. And then, you know, lobbyists could say, yeah, it's normal to give my client $1 zillion, you know. And so that's kind of the critique of it. So on the surface level, everybody wants, it seems like a lot of people want term limits. But, you know, there are other sides of it.
Well, Ohio knows a thing or two about term limits, right? I mean, we have them here. That's why people bounce back and forth between the House and Senate. So we have term limits on the House and the Senate, but not both.
Right? Yeah, I was going to say we kind of have term limits. I mean, and it was interesting that Speaker Matt Huffman was at this press conference advocating for congressional term limits, because Huffman, you know, certainly not the only lawmaker to do this, but he is an example of someone who's ping-ponged back and forth between the House and Senate to lengthen his tenure. So
we'll leave it there. We'll see what happens. This is the Reporter Roundtable from All Sides. I'm Amy Jurevich. With me in the studio, Haley B. Miller, state government and politics reporter for the Columbus Dispatch, Laura Hancock, state policy and politics reporter for Cleveland.com, and Megan Henry, a reporter for the Ohio Capital Journal. So there was a vote in the Ohio Senate, and it came out 30-2 to ban student cell phones in K-12 classrooms. We don't normally see a lot of overwhelming bipartisan support, and only two Democrats voted no. Lawmakers want to put something in place by the next school year, so it heads to the House. Can you tell us about this cell phone ban, Laura?
Yeah, Governor DeWine requested it. Last year, he requested, and the legislature followed through with a requirement that every school district in the state have about when and you can and cannot use a cell phone if you're a student. And then DeWine got some anecdotal evidence from school districts saying, hey, kids are actually, like, you know, not always like hunched over looking at their phones, but they're actually having in-person conversations and they're doing better academically and their mental health is better. And so DeWine came back this year at the State of the State and said, please, let's just go all the way and generally ban it during instructional time, during class time. There are some exceptions. Those include if you've got like a health thing that you need technology to monitor, the school board can consider giving you an exception for that. If you have a learning disability and part of your like learning disability plan requires, you know, maybe, you know, you need something to read text if you're vision impaired, you know, that kind of thing. And then also, say we're gonna teach students about AI. So everybody grab your phone. You know, if there's a legit reason to use technology, that would also be an exception. So it's now in the House. They want it to get out. They want it to go into effect September 1. And so in order for them to do that, they don't have a lot of time. They got to pass it in the next couple of weeks.
And Megan, I mean, what do you make of this, the idea of completely banning cell phones in schools? Do other states do this? Is Ohio going to be a leader in this?
So other states do. About 20 states have either a full ban in place, like Ohio is trying to do, or like a partial or just having policies in place regarding cell phone use in school. So whereas Ohio wouldn't be necessarily a leader, they would fall in line with about half the states and having some kind of policy in place. So currently, Ohio school districts have to have a policy in place come July. And so this bill would just bolster it by saying that the policy would have to be no phones in schools, because some school districts do already have a ban in place, or they say, like, okay, you can use your phones during these certain times during the school day, such as during lunch or perhaps a study hall or something along those lines.
Now, I talked on Tuesdays, we have a segment called Tech Tuesday, and a few weeks ago we talked to a tech expert about the cell phone thing, and she was saying that students will just find a way around it because they all carry around laptops and do all their schoolwork on laptops, so they'll all just, like, text on the laptops instead. I don't know. Does DeWine care about that, or is it just mainly it's the social media on the cell phone that he wants shut off?
Yeah, I really haven't heard that discussion come up among lawmakers, but I think that's a valid point. I mean, I can text on my MacBook, so I'm not sure yet if schools would put Wi-Fi restrictions in place if you're on the school Wi-Fi, blocking certain websites, or I'm sure there are ways around that, but I have not really heard that come up.
I've also heard from some teachers who say that just policing the cell phones sometimes is just not worth the extra time. But I guess if it's a statewide ban, they have a little more like oomph behind them if they tell you to go put your phone in your locker. Mm-hmm. Would you think that's true, Laura?
Yeah. And maybe even the district would give some money to provide the Yoder patches that everybody uses.
I don't know what that is.
It's just it locks your phone. It's so you put it in. When I went through the Prince Museum in Minneapolis, I had one, and they just put it locks your phone, and you can carry it around. And then they then when it's time to get your phone back, they put
it
in. Oh,
you mean
key.
Like the little baggie you put your phone in, so mm-hmm. you can't use it? Oh, okay. I had to do that at a show for a comedian. I went to see John Mulaney, and
cool.
You have to put your phone. You have to put your phone in a bag, so you can't, because it ruins his act if you film it and put it on YouTube, I guess.
Yeah, right. and lots of schools already have these.
Really?
Up in Northeast Ohio, I know a bunch of districts use them.
All right. Well, I guess we'll see. So anyway, we got onto an aside about John Mulaney. But basically, do you think this will pass the House? I mean, they'll push it through? Like, what would be the no?
I don't really know that many lawmakers who are pro kids being distracted. Because when you get, like, you know, eight texts in an hour, that's a minute you're away from, you're not paying attention to your teacher. And so I don't know how many, I think this is not a super controversial issue. It's a way to gain some political capital with DeWine, so then they can come back to him and try to negotiate something that they want that he might not be so, warm about. So, yeah.
I guess the only thing that I could see is maybe parents being against this because of issues with, worries about school shootings or lockdowns in schools, and just parents would love to, if a situation like that happens, as horrible as it is, it happens, and you'd love to be able to text your kid and be like, are you okay?
They did a amendment last week before it passed out of the Senate that said that school districts can decide how to allow or disallow cell phones in their school safety plans. So in some cases, I think in some school districts, they would be allowed to have them.
So you could still carry it around. That way you could turn it back on if you needed to. Is that okay? We'll see. All right. We'll see what happens with that. In more education related news, Laura, the House version of the budget bill, there's a proposal to drastically reduce the size of the State Board of Education. It calls for eliminating all the elected positions. Why do we want to do that?
Well, they would argue that the state school board doesn't have any power because they took it away.
Right.
2 years ago, the state school board used to be, you know, over the Department of Education, which did testing, which distributed the school funding, vouchers for private schools, created model curricula and learning standards. Anyway, they just did all sorts of stuff. All that's been transferred to a new education agency, Department of Education.
And workforce.
Yeah, yeah. And do, it's called. And then, so now the State Board of Education is just kind of like a licensed regulatory agency. So they license teachers and then they look into, like, they do investigations of educator misconduct and then take, you know, licenses away or suspend them as appropriate. So they're saying that they don't need 19 members, 11 elected, and then 8 that are appointed by the governor, that they only need 5 all appointed by the governor. This is just, you know, the state school board was elected, like the voters in the 50s created the state school board because it used to be like the education used to be under control of the governor and it got too political. So they created the state school board in the Constitution. And so this is just kind of like another way the legislature is gutting, and they've been kind of keeping an eye, and they wanted to kind of take control of education for a while. But what made them, I think, finally do it was 3 Democrats were elected to the board. And I think that's when they were like, all right, we're going to finally do this.
One of them being member Teresa Fetter. Mm-hmm. She's an elected member to the state school board. She's a former Democratic lawmaker. She opposes this move, obviously. She spoke up at a recent meeting. What did she have to say?
She just said that, you know, combined, I think they had around 200 years of experience, because a lot of the people who are attracted to these kinds of jobs are teachers. So they had all this education experience amongst them, and then just taking it down to 5 people. There were, there's concerns that there's just not going to be as much knowledge and nuance if you have that. Especially if they're all appointed, because maybe the governor would, you know, appoint somebody who doesn't have a lot of education experience. There's also concerns that 5 is just not going to be enough for a quorum. I mean, you have to have a majority of members to vote to pass things
for them to show up to the meeting.
Yeah. And if you have 5 people, that might just be too low. So it's now in the Senate, and we shall see what happens.
All right. One more topic for this segment. Megan, you wrote about a proposed bill that would require Ohio school districts to have a moment of silence. Now, there's already a state law allowing teachers to have moments of silence in the classroom. So tell me about this change.
Yes. So the law currently says that schools may have a moment of silence. And so this would just change really one word in the law from may to shall. And so it would just bolster the current law by requiring this. It's interesting because we saw similar language in a bill from the last General Assembly that was by the same lawmaker who's introducing this bill, Gary Click, when it came to the religious release time. The law previously said that schools may have a policy, and then the law changed to shall have a policy. And so we're seeing similar language in this bill.
I understand kind of the may shall thing for the religious release time, but why does it matter for a moment of silence?
They are saying that this could help, you know, students' mental health, just having like a moment of calm during the day, and just kind of taking like a break from the hustle and bustle, kind of going along with our conversation on cell phones, just since students are bombarded by so many screens and technology. Lawmakers who are introducing this bill are saying that this could just be just like a break from all that, and help students just understand what it means to have a moment of silence.
Or if you're cynical like me, this is just another way to get God into the classroom.
That's what I was going to say. This doesn't necessarily mean a moment of prayer, but like most of the time when you think of a moment of silence, you think that you're praying for someone.
Mm-hmm. Correct. Yes. The sponsor testimony last week in committee, there was no like mention by the lawmakers who were introducing the bill of prayer. But I think that is, yes, I think will be a concern from people. It's just a way to get religion, more religion in the classrooms.
So do you think the ultimate goal would be that every district requires a moment of silence, like, I don't, in the morning or like after like a certain bell rings, then you, is that the goal?
Essentially, yes. The bill as currently written would not prescribe when this would have to take place or how it would have to take place. But that would be the general idea. The bill does say that students, if they don't feel comfortable, they can get up and leave.
Oh, dear.
So that makes it seem like it could be even more distracting, which kind of came up.
That's going to take longer than a moment if anyone gets up and leaves. And everyone's going to get up and leave because they'd much rather probably stretch their legs than sit still. I can hear a lot of giggling happening whenever there's moments of silence.
Yes.
Or eye rolling. It's reminding me of a moment of Zen. I don't know which what TV show is that.
Daily Show.
The Daily Show does the moment of Zen. I'm thinking of that. Okay. Well, anyway, we'll see what happens with that, right? All right. Well, after the break, we are going to talk about hemp and plans to regulate it. That's when the Reporter Roundtable continues from all sides on 89.7 NPR News.
Planet Money helps you understand the economy. We find the people at the center of the story.
Garbage in New York, that was like a controlled substance.
We show you how money influences everything.
Tell me what you like by telling me how you spend your money.
And we dig until we get answers.
I had a bad feeling you're going to bring that up.
Planet Money finds out. All you have to do is listen. The Planet Money podcast from NPR.
You're listening to All Sides and the Weekly Reporter Roundtable. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. With me in the studio today, Megan Henry, reporter for the Ohio Capital Journal, Laura Hancock, state policy and politics reporter for Cleveland.com, and Haley B. Miller, state government and politics reporter for the Columbus Dispatch. There is a movement by Ohio Republicans to make the weeks between Mother's Day and Father's Day, to call it Natural Family Month, to promote children and marriage. Laura, this bill is sponsored by Representatives Beth Lear from Delaware County and Josh Williams from the Toledo area. There's more than two dozen Republicans who have signed on. So tell me more about this proposal. What's the rationale for a proposed legislation for Natural Family Month?
They're not defining what a natural family is, but suffice it to say it's not LGBTQ families. The child rate of having kids has gone down. We're now at 1.7 children per couple, and to have like the replacement rate needs to be 2.1 children per couple. And so we're losing population, although, you know, there are immigrants. You have ways you can replace that in the United States, but a lot of people, like a lot of Republicans, you know, they don't want to open borders or, you know, a lot of immigrants here. So there's nothing. It's like totally a toothless bill. It's like if you say I am opposed to Natural Family Month, you know, you're not going to get, you know, criminalized or penalized. You know, there, it's just kind of like a rah-rah kind of month to encourage people to have kids. There's a lot of Democrats who are saying, well, there are proven policies, like you can offer, you know, paid or like maternity leave where a woman is guaranteed her job for 3 months, like in Washington, D.C.
That's a great way to support a natural family. There you go.
Or, you know, like you can offer, I mean, they're talking about kicking pregnant women off of Medicaid, you know, right now. So that would be not a, you know, family planning measure. You know, there's lots of things that you can do for families and pregnant women. We could have a child tax credit. We could make the earned income tax credit refundable, which in Ohio, our state one, is not refundable. I mean, there's policies you can do to encourage families. However, some of those policies, it should be noted, in Europe, there's a lot of paid family leave, and they have just a lower, you know, couples,
lower birth rate too. Yeah.
Yeah. And so they have some of those. And so some of it is just people are just choosing for lots of reasons not to have kids. I mean, housing is expensive in our country. It takes a long time to pay off student loans. You know, there's a lot of reasons why, but they want to do this rah-rah month.
we are going to do an hour on the natalism movement on Wednesday, which is related to this idea that comes from the Trump administration wanting to promote people having more kids. And we're going to talk about those plans on Wednesday at 10 a.m. So if you want to know more about this, it kind of is tangentially related, I would say. All right, moving on to get an update on hemp. Megan, the last time you were on, you had written about hemp, and I had ran out of time to talk about it at that point. There was a Senate bill that would require it be sold at dispensaries. Can you give us an update? What's the plan with hemp here?
Yes. So Ohio Governor Mike DeWine has been, you know, saying for a couple of, or at least a year now, how, you know, there needs to be regulations around hemp, and lawmakers tried to pass a bill at the last General Assembly, but kind of ran out of time, ran up against the clock, and so reintroduced a bill at the start of this General Assembly that, yes, would essentially require dispensaries to be the ones to sell hemp, which, of course, is causing concern for hemp shops around the state who are saying, you know, this could devastate my business or it could force me to close up shop.
Now, Haley, is there a reason thus far the hemp has not been regulated? We just have never gotten there?
So the 2018 Farm Bill legalized hemp nationally, and the idea at the time was to open up, like, industrial hemp and that kind of stuff, but a lot of these stores found loopholes to create stuff like Delta 8, which a lot of people refer to as diet weed, and it's basically like a loophole in federal law that allows stores to sell gray market cannabis, so Delta 8, THCA, things that, you know, have similar effects to Delta 9 THC, which is kind of your standard marijuana. So this bill is aiming to close that loophole, essentially.
Now, it's been a while since we talked about the marijuana bill that was moving through the legislature. If you had written about hemp recently, have you been keeping up on that? Do you know where the marijuana legislation stands that was trying to kind of walk back a few things that voters had voted on?
Yeah, that is still in progress. I mean, there's a lot of different ideas about marijuana out there right now. There's a couple different bills. There's stuff in Governor Mike DeWine's budget that I think now the Senate is debating if they're going to do anything with marijuana in terms of taxation or things like that. So there are just a lot of ideas out there, and I don't think lawmakers have completely reached a consensus yet in terms of what they want to walk back from the voter approved law, what they want to keep in place. I think at minimum, they want to change how it's taxed and change where some of the money goes.
And Megan, are they keeping this hemp bill separate from marijuana? Or are these two different issues at this point?
It depends on what chamber you're in. And so I believe in the Senate, they are separate. In the House, it is combined in one bill. Is that correct?
I do not remember, but
that's okay. I'm sure it'll come up again. We'll keep you updated on where that all stands. This is the Reporter Roundtable from All Sides. I'm Amy Jarovich. With me in the studio is Megan Henry, a reporter for the Ohio Capital Journal, Laura Hancock, state policy and politics reporter for Cleveland.com, and Haley B. Miller, state government and politics reporter for the Columbus Dispatch. And Laura, you wrote a story for Cleveland.com about school transportation. There was a busing issue at the start of the school year here in Columbus, where Columbus said they were not going to drive certain students. This was public school students and private school students, if they were more than a 30-minute ride away. There was lots to that. But this change in transportation happened with little warning at the beginning of the school year. So things went back and forth. For the most part, I think some busing resumed. But anyway, the focus of your story was the funding piece. So what is happening with the budget when it comes to school transportation?
So the legislature is giving the House version, okay? So the House gives more money than they currently have. They're going to get around, I think, $840 million this school year. So by the time that ends, that's what districts will have received. It's more than that. Next year and then the following fiscal year, according to the budget plan in the House, it would be $940 million in the second fiscal year. So it is significantly more. The problem districts are saying, and the districts, it was really interesting, districts do get fined for not providing transportation. So I followed Cleveland because that's our readership area. And I mean, they lost $117 million this year for not, or $117,000 this year However, they get like $15 million in transportation, so that's like nothing. But that was because of not picking up private school kids last year. So they just deduct it from the following year's money. And Columbus at times has lost like over $1 million. And you know, the Ohio Supreme Court, like Dave Yost wanted the Ohio Supreme Court to force Columbus to transport kids. Columbus said that they couldn't because of their busing shortage. And the school district or the Supreme Court ultimately decided to dismiss the case because, yeah, state law says you have to provide transportation to these private school and charter school also students. But if it's going to take you more than 30 minutes, the law does not require you to transport them. And so, however, they want the school board to notify the families 30 days before. And school districts are not doing that. And the reason why I was told in my reporting is that usually they don't like count, like busing routes aren't decided until the second or third week of July, and that's because the central office doesn't send to the transportation department the number of how many kids are going to what school, so they can't even do it. So then that just doesn't provide enough time to do the 30-day warning. So
yeah, if I remember correctly, because this happened all last August, but if I remember correctly, from Columbus's point of view, in some cases it was cheaper or more cost effective, I guess I should say, to pay the fine rather than bus one student on like a 45-minute drive or something like that.
Right. And there's like one school district up outside of Toledo that has actually more buses transporting kids outside the district to private and charter schools than it does have buses transporting in district schools. So it is kind of, they would say it was a burden.
Is there anything in the budget to help increase the number of bus drivers? Because, I mean, in the heart of it, it is just that there are not enough bus drivers. Buses are expensive to buy. They need more.
Yeah. There's nothing for, and there's like a big retirement thing going on. A lot of bus drivers, the average age nationally is 57 years old. And in some districts, 14 to 15% of their bus drivers are retiring per year, and they're not hiring on at that rate to replace. So there isn't anything like that. However, the House budget doesn't create kind of an interesting thing where it would allow school districts to do ride shares.
Allowed them to use Uber?
Yeah, and Lyft and stuff, provided there's like all these safety things. You have to have like the driver has to have certain things, and, you know, there's all this safety stuff. GPS has to be, you know, they have to allow GPS to be followed either by the school or by the parent, you know. But so say you have a kid, just one kid going to a private school that you need to like transport, you know, that maybe doing a ride share would be easier than like doing a whole bus route. And so that's one of the things that they're looking at. And then like at the Ohio, I talked to a guy at the Ohio School Boards Association who thinks that basically private schools should maybe get permission or get money to buy their own buses. And then they could, as far as their bus driver training and then their, like bus maintenance, they could just contract with the local school district to do that that side, because they think that private schools would have a completely different pool of like congregants of the church, if it's a church school, volunteers, things like that, who would be willing, and that would be like a different pool of people to tap into for bus driving that, you know, public schools don't have.
So find bus drivers at the actual school where they go. All right, we'll see what happens. We have a couple minutes left. Megan, you wrote about how all five Ohio diversity centers have named their executive directors. Can you tell us what's going on there? Remind us about what these Ohio diversity centers are.
Yes. So this harkens back to the last budget in 2023 that was signed into law about 2 years ago that put these intellectual diversity centers in place at Ohio State University, University of Toledo, Wright State, University of Cincinnati, and Miami University. to prop up these centers. And they're all kind of at different points. Some, the University of Toledo has already started classes. They've been doing classes for about a year. Ohio State University is planning on starting classes this fall. And the other centers are trying to figure out a timeline of when to have these classes. But basically, these centers are ideally supposed to be to have like ideas of constitutional like law or like principles of the Constitution upheld through these classes. So there are lots of like civics discourses about the Ohio Constitution or, you know, how a bill becomes a law and things like that. So there was controversy at the time when these centers were written into law, and so it's interesting to see them now starting to be propped up.
Yeah, it is interesting also that they're called intellectual diversity centers, because now in this year the word diversity is one that we want, or that we're avoiding, right? So are they keeping that name?
That's a good point. As far as I know, that is the name overall, but these centers have specific names at each university, such as, you know, the Civics Center, or
Ohio State's is called the Chase Center. Yeah,
yes, named after people. So yes.
All right. Well, we only have a minute left. I was going to ask for a weekly Browns update. Haley, do you think you can give us an update on the new Browns Stadium in less than a minute?
Sure. NFL Commissioner Roger Goodell was in Columbus last week meeting with Governor Mike DeWine, state lawmakers, presumably pushing for the stadium. While all that was going on, Cuyahoga County and the Browns continued to fight with each other. And now it sounds like the Browns are saying, well, we don't need the county money. Mm-hmm. But I assume they would like that state money. So we'll see what happens with the budget in the Senate.
Yeah, the Browns apparently sent a pointed letter to the county executive there saying that he needs to get on board, basically. We will update more on that as it comes. But I want to say thank you to our guest today. Thank you, Haley B. Miller, state government and politics reporter for the Columbus Dispatch. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
And Laura Hancock, state policy and politics reporter for Cleveland.com. Thanks, Laura.
Thank you.
And thank you to Megan Henry, reporter for the Ohio Capital Journal.
Thanks for being here. Thanks for having me.
And this has been the Reporter Roundtable from All Sides. I'm Amy Jurevich on 89.7 NPR News.